Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Everything else just sounds like...
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
It's a brand new podcast.
Debate hockey.
I don't touch salmon at all.
Oh, that's refreshing.
Pop culture.
I can dig it. Can you dig it?
And more hockey.
I fought a Rottweiler and you got blocked by Ryan Whitney.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Let's start the show proper, shall we?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to ESPN's Hockey Today. Oh, wait, no, that's right. It's the Merrick versus Wyshynski podcast. Just like that podcast often does, we are doing today's show over the phone for maximum audio quality, Jeff Merrick.
Yeah, you know what we're doing today, Greg, as I texted you a few moments ago. Today we're showing our commitment to hockey. Or some other BS that coaches say to players all the time. We're really showing a commitment to hockey today, boys. Never give up.
Never give up, never surrender. It was essential that we do the show today, obviously, because there was a blockbuster trade from the Toronto Maple Leafs to the Ottawa Senators. We'll get to that in a second. I am in the bowels of the rock, as you can hear. Things are being rolled by. It's very exciting. You are, sir, in the bowels of a hospital, if you wanted to enlighten the listeners
of the,
about that.
Yeah, of the Markham Stouffville variety. And thanks to everyone that sent concerned tweets and texts and emails. Everything's okay. My dad kind of had a little bit of a scare. It lasted about a week here, and we had to get past yesterday, and we did. And so we're on the road to recovery now. So I thank everyone for their well wishes. I apologize for my absence. But I'm now finally getting back into work mode. So I apologize for the bags under my eyes, which you will see on television Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I apologize for a labored voice that I may have right now. But it's been a trying 7 days, let's just say, Greg. So thank you for sent along kind thoughts. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, prayers and thoughts for you and your family, obviously. And again, the level of commitment off the charts here. Your grit factor, your leadership you're exhibiting doing this podcast in such trying times, above and beyond the call, my friend. That's why people tune in to this silly podcast, because if nothing else, we are unable to prioritize life.
Do you remember the last time I did this podcast at the hospital?
I don't. When was it?
It's when Brody was born.
Really?
It was like 5 hours after he was born. And Claire was like, are you going to do the podcast today? And I'm like, well, hang on, we just have our second kid. She's like, well, yeah, like we're just like sitting around. Like, why don't you go do the podcast? Get the hell out of the room.
Take things off your mind for a while. Exactly right.
That's when I dropped the whole Brody reference, because I wanted to get it was our second son's name is Brody Quinn, and I wanted Brody Quint because one of my favorite movies, Jaws. And my wife looked at me and said, you get one.
I'm here in Jersey for the Brodeur night tonight. It's been fun being here for the celebration so far. Brodeur spoke to the crowd earlier today, and it was really fun. He told some fun stories. He was asked why he picked number 30. He said, well, you know, back in the day, you didn't really have a choice. You were given your number. You didn't go to Lou and say, I'd rather be number one, which is what he was as a young player in the minors. So it's some real cool stuff to say. But the coolest thing, obviously, is also being here. You get to talk to some cool people. So after Merrick and I get done rambling about this FNUF trade, you'll hear an interview with Jacques Lemaire, which might be a career highlight for yours truly, sitting down and shooting the shit with Jacques Lemaire and getting some laughs and chuckles out of the guy. And then also at the end of that interview, you'll hear him talk about the Minnesota Wild as an expansion team, which is worth the price of admission.
No way.
I pat myself on the back. It's fantastic. And then after that, the man himself, the man of the hour tonight, Marty Brodeur, sits down with us for about 10 minutes to talk about a number of things, including I love talking to Marty, because you get into interesting territory. We talked about, you know, the perception of him as a star player, vis-a-vis the perception of the Devils franchise and the trap, and talks about how in 2002 it really took him winning a gold medal before people really kind of took notice of how good he was. And then also, you know, in the same way, it's like, you know, what did you think of the trapezoid? Was it sort of an honor to think that they had to change the rules because you were that good? So some really interesting stuff out of Marty as well.
You know, I've always wondered too if at one point, and maybe he hasn't even done this, that he buried the hatchet with Patrick Waugh, because there was like legit venom
between Marty Brodeur and Patrick Roy over 1998 in Nagano. And it was essentially Patrick Roy with the caveat, hey, listen, if I'm going to play on this team, I play every single minute of every single game.
Yeah.
And, you know, Marty's like bringing his entire family. Oh, what? Oh, that's a code blue. That means bad, by the way. I talked to a doctor yesterday. When you hear code blue at a hospital, that's like heart attack or
that's a code blue
that just went off right now. But yeah, like it was legit. I mean, he, you know, lugged the family over there too to watch, you know, to watch him, you know, open and close a gate while Patrick Waugh sucked up all the minutes. Like here's the Olympic experience. I remember reading Marty's book, and he was sort of, let's just say, quite put out by that, as you can imagine he would be. But
I won't spoil it, but part of that Lemaire interview is me asking the question, Marty or Patrick Waugh, and then you'll have to listen to it later on in the podcast to hear the answer.
We got
bigger fish to fry. We got 30-year-old defenseman making $7 million against the cap, being traded to a team's division rival. The Dion Phaneuf trade comes down this morning in true Lou Lamoriello fashion. No one was expecting it. Phaneuf, captain of the Leafs, goes to the Ottawa Senators with Matt Fratton, Casey Bailey, Ryan Rupert, a defensive prospect named Cody Donahue for Jared Cowan, Colin Greening, Milan Mihalik, Tobias Lindbergh, and Ottawa's second-round pick in the 2017 draft. And Merrick, the big news, obviously, no salary retention whatsoever on this contract.
So when you break it all down, and these players have expiring contracts, which aren't expiring this year, but next year. But when you break it all down, essentially what the Maple Leafs did was traded Dion Phaneuf and his contract, which is ample and for a number of years as well. It doesn't expire, I think, until 2020 or 2021, in exchange for a second-round draft pick. And when you look at what, you know, remember last year's trade deadline when they were pretty close with Detroit and the deal was going to be, I remember sitting there on deadline day at our desk and getting all these texts and saying, hey, you know, they're warming up, they're getting close, they're playing footsies right now with Detroit. What was going back the other way was Brendan Smith and a second round pick in exchange for Dion Phaneuf. But the caveat was the Maple Leafs had to eat as much as half the salary.
Yeah.
So by sitting a year, you've improved your lot in life. Like, again, like this is sticking with, you know, that plan that we keep hearing out of, you know, Brendan Shanahan and Lou Lamoriello, like the long term, like everything that we're doing has this one singular focus. We're able to eat some bad contracts in the short term here as long as it, you know, A, gets us cap space and B, gets us either a pick or a prospect. Like, they continue to do it. Like, the fact that it happened today and the fact that it was Dion Phaneuf today should be a surprise to your point because no one saw it coming in true Lou fashion. But the fact that this is what the trade is really shouldn't surprise anyone because this is how the Maple Leafs are trading. And they're trading with eyes to the future, not eyes to right now. And they will absorb McCulloch's salary. They will absorb Greening's salary. They'll take those short term if it means long term freeing up cap space to sign some of the bigger fish that may be out there. Maybe there's another captain whose name isn't Shane Doan who might be testing free agency come July 1st.
Well, let's talk about that real quick because, you know, the Stamkos thing is obviously a big deal here. What is he going to sign to join, though? That's my question about this. And it's always interesting to see how the goalposts get moved on the Leafs conversation. It was a time when it was, Stamkos will come to the Leafs and take less money because he can make up all these endorsement deals to make up the salary. Now it's, now they've cleared out all the salary to max contract the guy. So, yeah. You know, it's either, you know, we'll give him all the money or just some of the money.
You know, another thing to think about through all of this is, I mean, and I don't know if he ends up taking, I don't know if he ends up getting max if he ends up testing on July 1st and signing with Toronto. But if he's going to be a Canadian living in and around Toronto, with the Canadian dollar being where it's at, making U.S. funds. Like, let's not lose sight of that, too. Like, if this is a 65-cent dollar that we're going to talk about here, he's being paid in American funds. Thank you very much.
Right. I just wonder now that, I guess when the Phaneuf trade came down, I guess my first thought was, wow, this really is a long-term rebuild. You know, it really kind of brought it home to me that they threw out all the salary. This is an empty shell of a team until the kids start arriving. You know, when they talk about 3 years and they talk about 4 years with Mike Babcock and the brain trust in the front office, you kind of like say, oh yeah, whatever, they're just trying to lower expectations. But this is one. This is shaping up to be one of the longest long game rebuilds I think the NHL has ever seen, and I think that Shanahan and the rest of them have commitment to it.
The key to it all is, and this is where the Oilers have sort of faltered, is, and we've talked about this countless times, having players that can play the game at a high level between the ages of 25 and 30. Like when you're filling your team with whomever the Maple Leafs get in their top five this year, maybe top three, maybe number one, you know, plus Mitch Marner, plus, you know, Morgan Riley, plus Nazem Kadri, plus, you know, whomever, Willie Nylander, whatever some of those other Maple Leafs players can turn into as well. You're going to need some guys that are veteran but are still young. Like, it didn't work with Edmonton because, you know, here's Ryan Smith to teach the kids. Well, all the kids do is snicker behind their back about, you know, the old guy. You know, here's, you know, Andrew Ferentz, who can't play at that level anymore. Like, you can't just bring in older guys and expect everyone to, you know, automatically learn from them because they can't relate to them. But the last time I checked, Steven Stamkos is 26 years old. Dion Phaneuf is 30 years old. So by the time this team actualizes, Steven Stamkos is still going to be right around the ages of 29 and 30. Dion Phaneuf would be 35. Like, everything really lines up here, Greg. Like, it really does. When you look at the MO of how you groom along a young team, you can't just fill it with, you know, guys that are on their final lap, and and they can already see the clubhouse and they're winding it down, putting for par and calling it a career. Like, they want guys that can still play between 25 and 30. And if it's someone like Steven Stamkos, they're more than ready to open the vault and say, you know what, take what you need, just don't embarrass us.
Right, exactly. But I come back to that general thought, though. Like, it's hard for me to conceive him going there sometimes, and this is one of those times, because they're not going to contend for at least 2 or 3 years.
Correct.
And if there's one thing he's talked about, it's the idea of going someplace and making some coin, but he doesn't want to go through another rebuild. And I find it to be – I find that piece of the puzzle not fitting for me when it comes to Stamkos and Toronto. The geography fits, the money fits, the trust and management fits. Maybe you like the coach better than Cooper. But I just don't see that other facet of it of what if you go there and you don't win for 3 years and then the rebuild fails?
Yeah. I guess you weigh it against, you know, do I want to play in a place where I can win, but I'm not happy? I can win, but I'm not playing the position that I want. I can win, and I'm not seeing eye to eye with this player, coach, GM, whomever. I guess that's what you weigh it against. But we're all assuming Toronto, too. And I think that, you know, it'd be folly to think that there won't be more teams, hello, Nashville, I'm looking your way, that would make a play for Steven Stamkos come July 1. I mean, we're pretty quick to say the preferred candidate here is Toronto because everything lines up and everything makes sense and everything is pointing in that direction, except when you come back to your point. But there are still some guys that, you know, they want to take that shot. You know, I mean, you look at the way, I mean, here's a little experiment for you to do, everyone listening to this podcast right now. If you want to understand what it means to win hockey games and win championships in Toronto, go look at the last lineup for the 1967 Toronto Maple Leafs. And that was the last team to win the Stanley Cup, as we all know, for the Maple Leafs. And see how many of them are in the Hockey Hall of Fame. Greg, it's like freaking everybody. It's like all you have to do is win in Toronto. Like, that's it. Like, that was the cheese in the trap for Babcock. That's the lure for Shanahan. Like, that's part of the luster, I'm sure, for someone like Lou Lamoriello at the twilight of his career. And for someone like Steven Stamkos, when you throw in the family situation, living here, you know, the local ties, the position for him, you know, step in and be captain of the team, you know, the one of, if not the most important team in the NHL. I know winning's always at the front of everybody's mind, but if at least there's a vision and a plan and you can see it, and we're seeing it today with the Phaneuf trade, maybe that makes you a little bit warmer to the idea that it's not a rudderless ship anymore. This isn't just, well, we're going to see what we can slap together come free agency and trade deadline and, you know, across our fingers and spit and hope that we do well. At least now everybody, like everyone in the whole hockey world right now can see exactly what the vision for this team is and can see the route that they're on and see the path that they're heading down.
Me and Dan Rosen talked about this in what will now be a bonus podcast because I didn't know if you and I were hooking up today or not. And lo and behold, through the miracle of phone technology we have. But I kind of find this, I like this move from an Ottawa perspective for a couple of reasons. One, because Phaneuf is never going to play the minutes that he had in Toronto. He's never going to have to be that guy in Ottawa.
Yes.
Eric Karlsson's the man.
Yes.
Phaneuf's the second pairing guy. I like that. I like the leadership he brings to that team. And I know that's one of those cringy, what about his analytics kind of things. But, you know, you talk to anybody around the Leafs, and he's a leader. Like, he's a stoic guy. He's a scary guy. But he's also a guy that the other players genuinely like. And if you look at that Ottawa roster and you say to yourself, okay, where's that guy on that roster? I don't know who he is. Is it Robbie Ryan? Is it Turris? Is it Eric Karlsson? Yeah. Because I don't know if any of those guys really speak to me in the same way that Dion does, as far as a guy who can kind of rule the room and keep things in order. And that's an important thing too. So in the short term, and this is going to look bad when he's, you know, 34 or whatever, and making $7 million against the cap. In the short term, I like this move for Ottawa for where they are and what they want to do. I don't think it's a bad thing bringing him aboard. I think the problem is the contract's bad.
The contract's bad, and we've known that for day one. A couple of things here. One, a shot in the arm to Canadian hockey fans that are seeing one team try to go for it and get the playoffs.
Right.
The rest of the country is floundering like a fish in a Faith No More video. And the other thing is, you know, I think if you ask anyone around Toronto, the worst thing that could have happened to Dion Phaneuf in Toronto was the captaincy. Because he's not that guy. Like, as much as he is a leader, like, man, when you wear that C with the blue and white sweater, it's a target as much as it is a blessing. And I remember hearing the stories of exactly when it happened. We've mentioned it on the podcast before. It was the New Jersey Devils game. He steps up and hits and then fights Colin White. And, you know, the Leafs management, you know, went, you know, banana sandwich over and said, that's our leader right there. That's our captain. We can't do it right now. But that's the moment Dion Phaneuf became the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs in management's eyes. And probably the worst thing he could have done for him, because, you know, we think of that guy back in Calgary with that green Easton stick who was, you know, shooting like Scott, like Al MacInnis, and hitting like Scott Stevens. And why was he able to do that? Well, he played with Roman Hamrlick. Like, he played with Corey Sarich. Like, he didn't have to be the guy. And there are just some players that excel when they don't have to be the guy. And in Toronto, the center of the hockey universe, he was thrust into the role of being the guy and kind of caved under. You know, I'm actually surprised he did as well as he did, considering he's playing on a bad team with a messed up management staff and a bunch of players not knowing whether they were coming or going. The fact that he was able to, you know, embrace the idea, even though it was a bad one, of being captain, because it takes a special kind of person to be able to stand up to that kind of scrutiny. Like, I know a lot of people that would just, like, flat out turn it down. Like, no way, too much pressure, too much stress. I don't need that in my life.
Right.
But the one thing, whether you like Dion Phaneuf or not, is at least he embraced that. At least he was, you know, out there in his Red Bull baseball hat every now and then talking to the media. Like, at least he showed up, right? And
right.
He was that guy, because it is rare to find players. I mean, if you pull them individually and get them in a candid moment, like, honestly, would you ever want to be the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs? How many of them do you think would honestly say yes? I would
never say the fraction.
You never
want it. So kudos to the Senators for being aggressive and getting a guy that I think helped them in the short term. And kudos to the Brain Trust in Toronto for, you know, doing something that's very difficult to do in this day and age, which is find ways to get rid of bad contracts and not handcuff yourself by eating up, you know, picking up a large chunk of those salaries. And they've managed to do it three times. I mean, they picked up some money on Kessel, but that wasn't so bad. They do it three times, and you know, I was thinking about Brian Burke earlier. I was thinking about the fact that this was a guy who would always complain about how the bad contracts and the toxic contracts on his team when he was with Toronto were handcuffing him and not allowing him to do the things he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And yet here's Shanahan, and here's Lou, and here's Dubas, and all of them, and they've found a way to get out from under a trifecta of problematic contracts, and now are positioned to really, really make some headway with this team.
Here's what we've learned about the salary cap era and bad contracts. You can get rid of them as long as you don't want to win.
Right,
like as long as you don't have aspirations to win right now, you can get rid of bad contracts. But if you think, but if you're still in the game, like if you're still in the hunt, then you can't get rid of bad contracts. Or, sorry, I shouldn't say that. It's almost impossible to get rid of bad contracts. But when you throw
if it's around Christmas time and you're Brian Burke, then you can't get rid of any contracts because he doesn't trade anybody around Christmas.
He's got the Christmas freeze. Yeah. But this is like a further unraveling
the sort of Gordian knot that was the salary cap structure of the Maple Leafs pre-Brendan Shanahan, for sure.
For sure. All right, dude. Well, you be well. You and I will likely reconvene on Thursday. Coming up on the podcast, as I mentioned, Jacques Lemaire, former head coach of the New Jersey Devils and the Minnesota Wild, talking about Marty Brodeur, talking about the 95 team, and talking about the Minnesota Wild and his crazy days in expansion. Then you'll hear a brief musical interlude, and then you'll hear the voice of Marty Brodeur talking about his statue, memorabilia, the trap, the whole thing. It's going to be great. And those are the two interviews that we have for you today. And Merrick, what would you like to say to the people here at the end of our segment?
I was just going to say, this kind of sounds just like Frankenstein podcast. We should maybe do more of these. I'm serious.
Well, I mean, I would love to, except for the fact that, you know, it would require me getting my ass out of the house to go sit down with Jacques Lemaire and Marty Brodeur, which only happens when there's a number retirement, apparently.
I was thinking, can you talk to more Hall of Fame, like, ex-Habs and, you know, future Hall of Fame goaltenders? Like, can you go, like, talk to, I don't know, can you call, like, Doug Jarvis? He's another centerman from that dynasty Montreal team. Can you just call Doug Jarvis for the next podcast and sit down with him for half an hour? That'd be great. Would you do that for us, Greg?
It's really something that if I had the foresight to set it up with, like, some of the PR people, I think we could probably do more of these interviews. But, again, you're asking me to, A, leave the house, and, B, have plan things. And these are two things I'm not very good at.
Don't you understand? You have a new calling card. If I'm Greg Wyshynski, here's how every phone call I make to an NHL person that I want to interview, this is what it sounds like. It goes like this. Let's say I'm calling Doug Jarvis. Okay, you play Doug Jarvis, all right?
Bring, bring. Hello?
Hi, is this Doug Jarvis?
It is. I never miss a day.
Oh, well, hi, Doug. My name is Greg Wyshynski from Yahoo Sports. I'm the editor of the Puck Daddy blog. I'm the guy that got John Scott to the All-Star game. Now, let me tell you what I can do for you. But in the meantime, how would you like to sit down and do a nice little 20-minute interview about how glorious you were with the Montreal Canadiens and how the game has never seen a face-off sentiment quite like you? All-Star game.
Despite the ratings, I felt it was a disgrace to the All-Star game.
but if you think of what I could do for John Scott, think of what I could do for you, Doug Jarvis.
Oh, man, that John Scott stuff continues behind the scenes, but that's a story for another day.
I had a really positive conversation with someone with the Coyotes of the day who spoke glowingly about everything we did, to be honest with you.
Yeah?
Yeah,
that's interesting.
I was going
back and forth with somebody from the National Hockey League last night that isn't appreciative of the things we did.
Okay. Well, there is that.
I'll tell that story to you later. All right, anyway, hey, more stories to be told, courtesy of Jacques Lemaire and Marty Brodeur. Merrick, good luck with everything, and best to your pops.
Thanks.
And we'll talk to you, everybody, on Thursday. Me and Loza tomorrow, me and Merrick on Thursday. And
done.
Here, without further ado, what do you want to say, Merrick? You have something to say?
Nothing. No, I'm curious. I want to hear Jacques Lemaire. I want to hear Marty Brodeur. I want to hear Dan Moore. I want to hear all you guys.
Well, gosh darn it, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. Without further ado, the man who bestowed the trap upon the National Hockey League, and after him, the man who helped make the trap work in the National Hockey League, Jacques Lemaire.
Hang
and
on, half day.
Brodeur. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Greg Wyshynski here with one of the greatest coaches of my lifetime, Jacques Lemaire, sitting in the rock. What do you think of this arena versus where you used to coach the Meadowlands? What do you think in comparison here?
This is much better.
What was it about the old barn that you actually liked? I mean, was it, because I remember being in there when the crowd would not be too big and the style of hockey you guys played. I said to myself, maybe you're lulling the other team a little bit, right?
We tried to put the other team asleep.
All right, you're here back from Marty Brodeur night, getting his number raised to the rafters. When did you know Marty was something special? Do you remember the moment or the time when you said to yourself, okay, this guy is going to be one of the greats?
Well, you can't say that before he started to do well in net. You know, only scouts can say that. I picked this kid. He's going to be great.
Right.
Now, don't make sure you don't screw up with him, because that's the only way he won't be good. But no. As a coach, when he came in, I just saw that he had the ability to be good. Why? Because of his he was very athletic. He knew the type of plays that the opponent would do in the zone, which in those days, there's not a lot of guys, only the top goaltenders knew every plays that could be done in front of him. And I could tell, because Marty, sometimes he was going out to intercept a pass. You know, he did a lot of stuff that other goalies didn't do.
Where does that come from? Is that just natural born brain ability, or his training, or?
Someone mentioned to me that I thought was really important. It's maybe it comes from, you know, playing with a bunch of guys, 20 guys on the ice when he was young. You know, coming out of his net, tried to be a defenseman and all that, and he kept that, probably. And to me, it makes a lot of sense.
The style of play that you played, obviously, the trap, which I know in some corners is a dirty word, but I find to be it's a very effective offensive system as well as defensive system, for the record, Jock. Did you see Marty as being the perfect skill set to make that system work?
Oh, yeah. In a way, he's great, because we wanted to get the other team to throw the puck in. So we tried to put as much pressure in neutral zone as we can.
Mm-hmm.
So they fire the puck in. So we didn't want to open up getting stuck with only three guys in neutral zone. We wanted five.
Mm-hmm.
So when they shoot it in, we knew that Marty could make that play, and you know, because he was our third defenseman,
right?
And, often he could make a short pass by the board, a direct pass. He could make a long pass in neutral zone. So he's, you know, he could see the ice well, and rarely panic with it. With the puck when he had it.
When he was a young goalie, did you ever have to pull the reins back and say, don't try as many outlet passes, don't try to be as active?
I never told him that, but I told the goalie coach, he's starting to make me nervous.
so he's a young pup, he's a young kid. In 94, you guys go on that run, you lose to the Rangers in the conference final. How much do you think that helped him as far as his maturity into a championship level goalie, having that kind of a run early in his career?
Yeah, that's all what he missed, you know, getting in the playoffs, play against real top teams, get that competition, get that these games that he would learn, because he was learning all the time. And, you know, you get guys that learn, it takes a month before they learn one thing. Him, it was every day and quick.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it just sounds like his brain's a big sponge, huh? Like, he's just the smartest guy on the ice, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was really amazed how he could see the plays coming in front of him. It was really something to you know, that you would be amazed watching it over and over.
Mm-hmm. When As he matured, as he got better, how did you see parts of his game improve? Like, where were the holes in Marty's game when he first came up with you and the Devils?
I thought it was going out too much.
Yeah.
You know, sometime I you know, like I said, I was nervous.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't, but I was. and you know, the game is fast, and you got to come back in the net. He was coming here, stay here, wanted to play as a defense, make the play.
Yeah.
You got to come back there. If you miss that puck, it's in the net.
Now, one of the things that everybody I know appreciated about him during his playing days, he was always the nicest guy. He's a very sunny, sunny disposition, funny guy, always had a smile on his face.
Yeah.
When you're playing on this high of a level, when the expectations are as high as they were for the Devils when you were here, how important is it to have that type of personality in the room and be an important player, no less?
It's everything. You know, having a guy that enjoys the game, a guy that doesn't feel the pressure. The pressure doesn't grab him, because if it grabs him, he can't talk to that. He doesn't want anybody to talk to him. This guy, you know, you could talk before the game. You could talk about anything. He didn't mind.
Ready and available. Yeah.
Other guys. Like I said, they were sick before the game.
Which is really interesting, because he's a goalie. And usually goalies are the ones that don't want to talk to anybody around the game, right?
Yeah.
How does it make you feel to be back for one of these things? I mean, I saw your old partner in crime, Larry Robinson, walking around. I saw other people around. Is it good to come back and think about 95, to think about that championship here?
Oh, yeah. It's great. You know, when you win a cup, doesn't matter which team wins a cup, win the Super Bowl, you win all the big events in sports. You know, it takes a team, okay? Because we mention team a lot, and we never mention it like these champions.
Right.
Because the real team is when you become champions.
Yeah.
Then you look at it and you say, this team, we did this as a group, we did that, we did this, we did that. And you go on all the little things that makes that great team. And only when you win, you know what it is.
Right. Three more for you real quick. First off, when you see Scott Stevens wearing glasses, I mean, this guy used to murder people on the ice. He looks too smart now. He looks very, very like a librarian or a professor of some sort. Don't you think he should wear contact lenses?
No, I like his look, because I've seen the meanness in him for years. Now I see a doctor, so it's nice.
Second thing is, I have to ask you this. I'd be yelled at if I don't ask you this. You bleed Montreal colors. You're the former coach of the Devils. Wah versus Brodeur. Where do you stand on this hotly contested debate? You're looking at me like you can't answer this question. Like you literally cannot put it out there. Is it a tie?
I don't know. I can't answer.
Take the fifth. You just silence on that. I always say Hasek. I just split the difference and say Hasek all the time when I'm asked about that. And then finally, I was thinking about you the other day because, you know, we're talking about expansion in the NHL. We're talking about maybe a new team in Vegas. You, of course, were the coach of an expansion team with the Minnesota Wild. What was that like, taking over a fresh new team put together via an expansion draft?
That's a lot of headaches at the start. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
I remember when I first started in first day, I go to Minnesota and Doug Risebrough tells me, he says, hey, we got the guys skating. Oh, I said, yeah, where are they skating? So he tells me that arena. So I told Mario, I said, let's go, we'll go and see, you know, the guys, because I didn't know them.
They're all new guys, yeah.
So I go there, and Wes Walz was there, and that's the only one that I knew. And I'm looking at the guys, don't say a word to Mario, and then all of a sudden I say, how the hell we gonna win a game this year? So I said, Mario, let's go, it's time for a beer.
Well, it sounds like the coach of the Las Vegas Black Knights or the Quebec Nordiques have a lot to look forward to. Jacques Lemaire, you are a gentleman and a hell of a hockey coach in all of your stints here in New Jersey, including the ones we didn't know you were coming back for, but all of a sudden you're here and they almost make the playoffs and it was crazy. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Greg Wyshynski here with Marty Brodeur on Marty Brodeur Night. So why wouldn't Marty Brodeur be here? I guess it's kind of required. I wanted to ask you about, I asked you about the statue. You like it. It's good likeness. Do you have all the stuff that was made for you during your playing days, like Marty Brodeur figures and stuff? They just send it to you, or do you have a collection of them?
You know what? It's a combination. There's companies that do send the product to the players. Sometimes we get it through the NHLPA, but it's funny. Like I got a couple of my buddies that are big memorabilia guys. They're big Devil fans. That Marty, did you ever see that? And they would just bring me like a little doll, a little picture, or whatever, you know. And so it's great. Like I was able to collect a lot of stuff. I'm sure I don't have everything.
Yeah.
But it's throughout the years, it's a bunch of stuff.
So this must be nice because I'm imagining from a lot of the stuff that's been made for you, you didn't get a chance to really sign off on stuff, right? Like this,
no.
And this statue is much more of a personal process for you.
Yeah, well, it's definitely different. Like, the likeness and everything, the NHLPA, doing the licensing, we're the one signing off. And I made a few phone calls, put it this way. There's some of them, I didn't really look like me, but all right, it doesn't matter. But the statue was great. You know, John did a great job, and, he designed it, and he made it, actually, and we kind of talked about what we wanted to look like, and it worked out well.
Yeah, and you obviously you mentioned you're in the victory pose out there. It's a good one. Were there other options for this on what you wanted?
Well, we just wanted something that the fans could relate to me. And so, like, saves are saves. You know, I mean, there's a couple of ways I make saves. It was playing the puck. There's a nice picture of me, like, with the stick, like, really flex and playing the puck. But I had my mask on. So,
yeah.
I'm like, it's not good. If I got a statue, I think I see my face at least.
Right, right.
And so that's why we came up with the hat, the mask, and salute on top of my head.
Jacques's back for this. I spoke to him earlier about you about how sometimes he would bang his head against the wall when you go out and try to stray a little bit. What did it mean, in thinking about your formative years here in Jersey, like him as coach, Caron as goalie coach, and then having that success early, I feel like was the foundation for a lot of the stuff that came later for you.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I think I was fortunate. I came into an organization, and Jacques wasn't really a coach that loved having young kids in the lineup right from the get-go. So for me, like, you know, I played, you know, back and forth with Chris Terreri, my first year, and I got the nod in the playoffs to play in 94, and, you know, 95, well, I became number one, the starter. But I got lucky. I played on good teams right away. You know, Jacques brought this culture about defensive hockey and being responsible. And, you know, as a goalie, like, you cannot ask for better than that. You know, these
right.
guys were committed to play good defense in front of you, so they didn't leave me out to dry many nights.
Yeah.
So, no, it was definitely the setup. It just worked out that way, but you couldn't ask for better than that.
I think there's a lot of underrated aspects of your game that you don't necessarily get credit for, and I think one of them was, you know, people looked at the Devils, were like, oh, look at the defense in front of them with Stevens and Niedermeyer and Danico, but, like, there are nights when you would face 14 shots, 13 shots, and keep your head in the game, and knowing the margin of error, because the team wouldn't exactly score four goals a night either.
Yeah.
I think that was probably a tough thing for a goalie to have limited chances and then knowing that you had to make each one count.
Yeah, well, every save became important. You know, I could go through stretches of 15 minutes in a game without getting a shot, you know, and so it's hard because now, like, you know, the next shot goes in and you're like, oh my God, I got, you know, one goal and two shots. You're like, huh, this is going to be a rough night, you know, and so mentally, you know, I had to work at it. What really helped me is because I love communicating with my players and playing the puck a lot. So that kept me really intense in the game because if they weren't shooting the puck, I was going to get it from them.
Yeah.
You want to make a bad dump in? Well, we'll make you pay the price. I would go and play, make plays, and, you know, talking to the defensemen, you know, not because I didn't get shot. Defensively, we were so good that, you know, teams would spend time in our zone but just wouldn't get nothing out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you still got to work these, you know, that minute that they're in our zone. So, you know, we had a great system. It was fun. These guys, everybody was committed from the defensemen to the forwards. You know, we had a good, and, you know, Jock, we had one of the best coaches. So.
When you were in the middle of it, did you ever think about the sort of that chicken or the egg argument people used to have about you with, you know, am I a product of the system or am I the reason the system works? Did you ever consider that?
Well, you know, we had a lot of success. We won some stuff, but it's funny how everything works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm in New Jersey. I know, you know, everybody knows we're a good team and, you know, I'm part of the system. You know, me and Scotty Stevens and Nino Meyer were the top guys, so we go to the All-Star games, we do stuff like that. But never on the big stage, we got recognized that much. And when I won the gold medal in 2002, I was like 10 years into my career, almost 10 years of my career. I haven't won a Vezina trophy yet. And now, from there, 2003, 2004, and I get all my accolades. Just because I got success outside, so they said, oh, he might be good. He wasn't with the Devils. But I was with Team Canada, so it was as good.
Yeah.
But so that's kind of funny a little bit. But you know what? I couldn't care less. I was winning.
Yeah.
Like, we're having fun. You know, we were on our own island, and I love that people hated us. All these guys, they're trapped. They play defense. It's boring. There's nobody in the stands. Or whatever they would complain about.
Yeah.
And because I stepped away from the Devils a lot with All-Star Games, Awards, Olympics, I heard a lot of these comments from other players. You know, they hated to play against us, and so that's kind of, that made me feel pretty good. Like,
you killed hockey. I don't know if you did.
Yeah, exactly. Beautiful.
So to that end, then, and I want to get back to the goalie stuff in a second. But to that end, did you view the trapezoid as sort of being an honor? I mean, I know it was a pain in the ass at the end of the day, but it's a rule that was kind of made because you were really, really good at something.
Yeah, there's a couple guys. You know, I think we brought it to a level that it became. For the NHL, something is, well, we got to change this because it's not, the goalies are getting too good and they can't get hit. We got to do something. But I was never really mad about it. Like, people thought, I can't believe they're doing this to you. I'm like, all right, this is a trade-off. If I go in the corner, there's a good chance I'll make a mistake because my net is a long way away. So
right.
That kind of saved me probably from turnovers big time. And they gave me the opportunity to shoot the puck all the way to the other blue line because at the same time, they took out the red line.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, it's a trade-off. You know, I'm able to, you know, throw guys in breakaways a lot more often than go in the corner. The only thing I didn't like is I couldn't help my teammates out not getting hit anymore.
Right.
That's what, like, every year, like, with Dano, they loved it. Like, they never had to get hit in the corner. I would get the puck, shoot it, they would go hit, you know, and that was really the thing. That now, and the puck that's sitting there, and I would see it. Sorry, boom.
Right.
I could do nothing about it. Until
no touch icing, then that was taken
care of.
Well,
that was just the last few years. So,
did you ever say to Shanahan, "You're like, what the hell are you doing this with trapezoid stuff?"
I mean, yeah,
you're the guy that invented this thing.
Yeah, well. Now that I'm gone, they probably get switched back.
Yeah, probably. You mentioned goalies before, though, and I thought your point was really interesting because it did take you a while to break through. And go on your run of Vezinas. I mean, you know, Hasek had his, and other goalies had theirs. And you brought up Corey Crawford, and I thought that was an interesting comparison because here's a guy having season of his life right now. I know you can't really talk too much about Corey Crawford having the season of his life right now, but there seems to always be that caste system in the NHL when it comes to goalies. There's the elite guys like, you know, Henrik and Rask and Pekka, and then there's the next tier, and I don't know what they have to do sometimes to get up. Like, even Jonathan Quick, who's got a couple cups to his credit, and Corey's got cups to his credit, they always just seem like they're like one tick down from the guys that are always in contention for the Vezina.
Yeah, well, like I said, like, it's funny how it works. Like, you get in the mix of the conversation and you can't get out of it. You know, and try. But the problem is, like, to get to that conversation, it's hard.
Yeah,
you got to do something special, and usually winning does it. But the thing is, like, when you win on good teams, people, well, the goalie wasn't important because Jonathan Toews is the MVP. But the goalie, I mean, think about last year, how Crawford going through what he had to go through, getting pulled and being sat down.
Yeah, Scott Darling.
And next thing you know, turn around and win a Stanley Cup after all that. Pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Not necessarily not to win the MVP, but at least to get recognized as one of the good goalies. And but again, there's a process. It's a picking order. And, you know, I was at seasons with 1.8, 0.6 goals against average, and Hasek would win it.
Yeah.
You know, and next thing you know, like I had the average stats, and I would beat out Longo.
And then you'd win, yeah.
You know? So it's just, it's kind of a pick and order for the people or the GM, you know, that votes for that.
How much, I mean, as American, I'm still pissed at you for 2002, but how much did that mean to you, that
run? It meant a lot, you know, because like I told you, like I got out of my bubble of New Jersey, and I was able to win for my country. I got the chance to play. You know, that was my second Olympic. I didn't get the chance to play in 98. So for me, it was an honor to be part of that team. But, you know, Team Canada, I think, you know, they won. But at that time, it was 50 years without winning a gold medal. So, I mean, that was a pretty amazing feat that we were able to accomplish that. And the fact that it was in North America, too, it was fun, you know, because our fans were involved with us. And it's not like you're in Europe or somewhere else, you know.
Two more. Your comments in your press conference about looking up at the rafters in Montreal and saying, you know, there's a reason that they're so high. It's because they seem unreachable. It does seem like you have a pretty good sense of the importance of getting your number retired. Is that true?
Yeah. Oh, that's true. I think you create your own destiny, you know, and you play hard. But you know what? Like, there's only a select few that gets their number retired, and you know, I'm really excited about it that they're giving this to me. Just because where I grew up, I know what it means, you know. And you know, nobody ever here in New Jersey will be wearing number 30, and you know, we get the statue, we get the whole thing, and it's all credit to me, but also to the people that were around me that made me who I became throughout my years here.
Well, I'm pretty sure they won't be wearing number 30 because now they can pick their own numbers, unlike when you were a rookie, exactly. As you said today.
Nobody wants 30 anyway anymore.
And finally, I grew up a Devils fan, and you said some really wonderful things earlier today about Devils fandom. I thought you really nailed it, which is there's not a lot of them, but the ones that there are like the most diehardest of diehardest of fans.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the relationship that I got with them, and it's, you could pick the games, I knew exactly where they're sitting. Like, they almost have routine as worse than me, some of the fans, you know. And just the fact that I've been there for so long, you know, and I got to know them. They, from the move from the Continental Arena, Airlines Arena to here, you know, these people, it's like, all right, now we go to an event. Now I'm in section this. I'm like, okay, thank you. You know, but it's just, like I said, it's more personalized, I think, than any other franchise. I don't think the Rangers or the Canadians or Toronto could know the fans as much as I was able to get to know personally some of the fans.
Yeah, and it also seems like that relationship is also a very respectful one. I mean, like I said, you're in Toronto, and you're in the fishbowl.
Yeah.
You're in Montreal, you're in the fishbowl.
Yeah, and the fact is, like, I met people like in 94, 93, 94, and they're going to be here tonight.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I mean, it's to their credit. I mean, the investment, everything you do for a sports franchise, and there's just one, there'll be a bunch of them that were there in my first game.
Yeah. For sure. Thanks, Marty.
All right.
Much appreciated.